Donal on a Kitchen talks about food. Donal on a Kitchen talks recipes. Donal on a Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donal on a Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We talk about food, farming advice, recipes, and opinions. We are glad that you can join us at our kitchen table today. And we come to you from the studios of KHOI Community Radio right here in the center of Iowa, Ames, Iowa. And as Donna says, we are kind of right in the middle of things here, and we like to talk about food. So food is usually what we get around to, and we're going to be talking about pork today. But first, I have a Donal on a Kitchen news item. Tick-a-tick-tick-a-tick-tick-a-tick-tick-a-tick. That's our ticker tape. We do have a news department. Yes, we do. So let's think about big things. Let's think about the planet. Let's think about Antarctica. Let's think about the ice shelf that has broken off into the sea. We don't often remember, I don't often remember that the world is round and there's a lot more to it than just what I see out my back window. And there was news this month, actually in the middle of last month, the news item came out that ice shelves are breaking off of the continent of Antarctica. And it was confirmed in the middle of March that the iceberg C-38, I don't know how they label these things, C-38 broke free from the Conger ice shelf. Huh? How does that affect us here? Who knows? Who knows?
Well, think of it like a glass of ice. That's all the ocean. So as the ice melts, we have more water, and will the glass get fuller?
Oh, boy, I don't know. It's not exactly a small chunk of ice. At roughly 1,200 square kilometers, the Conger ice shelf was about the size of Los Angeles. So it has been breaking off. It has been breaking off. It's not the whole continent. But, okay, despite that, quote, relatively small size, it is still considered a significant event. These days when geologists and climate scientists say a significant event, I sort of, you perk up and take notice, yes. The climate activist George Montiak, he says, we knew what was happening. The writing was on the wall, yet we carried on opening new oil fields and driving SUVs.
And continue to do so.
This global warming stuff, it's pretty, pretty amazing. Ice shelves are the floating tongues of glaciers that extend over the ocean. And they are contributing to the global sea level rise. So that's just another little bit of a news item. As I say, sometimes you have to think a little more about the land around us besides what is going on just outside our kitchen windows. So, Donna, shall we talk a bit about pork today?
Well, pork is the Iowa food, and, you know, I must say I do love pork and have been in places in the world where the pork is not nearly as good as our wonderful pork here. Now, today we had intended to have Paul Willis with us to interview, but something has happened to Zoom, and Paul is not here, so we're just going to talk about Paul.
See, that'll teach him.
Yeah, we can say whatever we want about him. So Paul is a dear friend, and I'm sorry you're not going to hear his voice today, but we'll just tell you the Paul Willis story. So Paul is a farmer from Thornton, Iowa, which is kind of up near Clear Lake, so north central Iowa, and he was growing organic corn and pigs. So in the 90s, when all the confinement feed operations started happening, Paul was not happy about this. And he decided, that he wanted to keep raising pigs the way, my uncles, for example, had raised pigs, Paul had the little houses out in the pasture, and the sows gave birth in the hog houses, and then they're movable. I don't know. You don't see them, of course, much anymore. But as a kid, many, many farms in Illinois and Iowa had these. They are portable. You can move them. And the way Paul was doing it was, of course, rotating his fields with the corn or the pigs. And the pigs, of course, deposit their manure. And he used, electric fencing. Not with pigs, you don't have to go too high off the ground. And I remember visiting numerous times. The baby piglets, of course, are adorable. So Paul had this. He kind of invented his own protocol. And then he went ahead and found some animal welfare standards. So it's 100% certified humane, 100% transparent publicity accessible protocols. 100% of the farms and ranches personally are inspected before they can join the Nyman Ranch. And 100% American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. They're certified with them too, and the farms are audited annually. No hormones ever, no tail docking, no teeth clipping, no antibiotics. And you can't have a gestation crate, which is something 2 by 7 feet or something that the pregnant sow. This is standard procedure in all of the CAFOs that you see all over Iowa. So with Nyman Ranch, the pigs have to have, they either have to have the hoop houses, like the little hog houses that Paul did, or they have to live in very large bedded, so they can have their normal, they're very social, pigs are very smart. The whole thing with Nyman Ranch protocols are you have to be able to let the pig have her normal social behaviors. Mm-hmm. And Paula always used to say, Nyman Ranch pigs only have one bad day in their life.
That's a good thing.
Yeah.
I want to talk more about Nyman Ranch. You may have seen Nyman Ranch brand in stores, which actually that was not an easy thing to do, getting a brand that is cruelty-free and environmentally sensitive and doing things the right way. You'd think that it'd be easy to get into the market for things like that, but it's been kind of a long road. Nyman Ranch is a big, big company now. And believe it or not, it was recently bought out by Purdue Farm. And,
I want to say something about that, because when that happened, I asked Paul what was going on. He said, well, actually, he felt that Purdue they bought Nyman Ranch because they want to learn how to do these more humane protocols and to integrate some of those principles. Of course, Purdue is a lot of chickens. But, he said already they started doing things like putting more windows in their chicken houses and things like that, because the writing is kind of on the, there are two things that the public is demanding more of. And one of them is, more humane standards for animals. Like, for example, both California and Massachusetts have passed laws that are going to affect this year, although they seem to be, of course, challenged in court. But the industry, the pork industry, for example, is, other than Nyman Ranch, not really prepared to deal with this, getting rid of CAFOs or changing the nature of it. But when states make a law like that, that means to enter the California market, you have to be compliant to these welfare standards. Mm-hmm. So Nyman Ranch, of course, is ahead of the game on that and has done a really good job of preparing for that. And the other issue is, of course, antibiotic use in animals. This is a huge, huge deal that people, the medical profession has been talking about this for years. 80% of the antibiotics sold in the U.S. are used for livestock production.
Ooh.
Now, the problem with that is, you know, the antibiotics only work for so long. The biotics, right? The viruses and germs, the germs, bacteria, eventually mutate enough to be immune to various.
They're smart too.
Yeah, right. It's kind of like the weeds that build up resistance to the glyphosate and stuff like that. You know, it's biology and life is always changing and growing. And so by using this many heavy antibiotics simply to feed the animals in conditions that are not conducive to their health, it's affecting the usefulness of antibiotics for humans. So that is a big deal. There was a 9% increase in antibiotic sales for pigs in 2019. This is recent. This is still going on. Another quote is, U.S. pork and beef producers use antibiotics at a rate approximately 3 to 6 times higher on a weight-adjusted basis than their counterparts in France, United Kingdom, Netherlands, and Denmark, all of which grow a lot of pork, right? So it can be done. It's just a different protocol. What Paul has done in creating Nyman Ranch, he had started growing his pigs a certain way, and he set out some standards. And then he approached a farmer in California that was selling beef, raised in similar, you know, humane and he just, that's why it's called Nyman Ranch instead of Willis Ranch, right? Or Willis Farm. Mm-hmm. But, so he piggybacked on with Bill Nyman, and then they built this company up. And then of course it's grown and grown and grown. But the main thing that you need to know is all of the farms producing the Nyman Ranch pork under this protocol, they're all family farms.
Yeah.
And a lot of them are here in Iowa. There are some throughout the Midwest. I think there's probably some also in on the East Coast, because that's also a large pork producing. But these are not confinement operations.
No. Nyman Ranch, the brand that you probably see, it's been a long haul. Nyman Ranch began in the early 1970s on an 11-acre ranch in north of San Francisco. They started out producing beef, lamb, and pork, but
that's Bill Nyman's.
Yeah.
Now, and there's several, Bill Nyman's wife, what is her name? Nyman. She has written several books about, you know, growing beef that way, but that also applies to our Iowa pork that Paul is raising and Paul's large amount of family farms.
I have some facts here about Nyman Ranch from Wikipedia. Where else does one get Wikipedia? Paul joined the Nyman Ranch organization, or was approached by them, in 1994. That is a while ago. The Nyman Ranch expanded and really kind of turned into a big company, because originally, even in the Wikipedia account here, it says originally Nyman Ranch was founded in 1969 by rancher William Nyman, and they called him a hippie, an elementary school teacher who kind of moved from Minnesota to California, and he kind of started this thing. And at first he started growing pigs, goats, and chickens, and then added cattle later.
He's known for his cattle. Yeah.
And there's the cattle. And Paul has done a lot to make this company well-known for pork, and just so happens that pork is something that Iowa does pretty darn well.
Well, I know that for many years, Nyman Ranch was, for example, one of the main suppliers for the pork for Chipotle. So that gives you an indication of the scale that these individual, largely from Iowa, but not exclusively, these individual family farms are able to produce, and then Nyman does the processing. And you know, it's the farmers get paid a premium for following this protocol. But that premium is what allows it to be, you know, which means it's a little more expensive, but consumers are very supportive of this. The products are, of course, really good. They did a study. They had Dave Swinson, who is an economist at Iowa State University, quantified for the first time Niman Ranch's significant contributions to the Iowa economy in terms of job and labor income. The report found that Niman Ranch's contributions are nearly double those of conventional producers.
Huh.
So, overall, in Iowa's 195 Niman Ranch farmers created 339 jobs statewide for every 100,000 hogs produced. Niman Ranch produces 152% more jobs across the state than its conventional counterparts. You know, so Niman farms depend on having more people working on them, and this is a selling point, more because it's more labor intensive.
Mm-hmm.
More people working locally help create stronger linkages to the local and regional economy. This is what Dave Swinson said. So Niman producers also lead the way with higher industry average wages and individual profits. So they're paying farmers more, they're paying laborers more. The study showed that for every $1 million in direct sales, Niman farms produce 14 jobs and generate an additional $103 million in other economic inputs, including labor income and value-added spending. So Niman farmers make contributions that go beyond just the purchases and transactions and dollars in your local communities. They are part of strong, vibrant communities and are helping to build the next generation of farmers. This is the other thing that Niman Ranch does. They have, like, well, first of all, they do an annual, usually in Des Moines, Niman Ranch Farmers Dinner. So the farmers are all invited, and it's a large event, and it's lots of fun because one of the things Niman Ranch Pork does a lot of marketing for restaurant chefs because it is a premium product, and you know, chefs are one of the people who really appreciate having a good product to work with. So what the Niman Ranch Farmer Dinners do is they invite a group of chefs, kind of diverse from all over the country. They fly them in here. They all cook together, and they make this dinner so the farmers get to eat, you know, in the way that people say in fancy New York restaurants do, with the food that they're growing. So this is always a lot of fun. And at the dinners, they also present what are called the Niman Ranch Scholarships. So the children of the Niman Ranch farmers are, you know, they're selected based on a competitive, you know, their scholastic records and stuff, but they are given some scholarships so that they can continue to study, usually agriculture. And it's a, you know, it creates a, I mean, just having this event on an annual basis, and I have been to many of them, I really enjoy them. First of all, the food is always really
good. That's a good reason.
And there's pork in every course. It's fun. It's really fun. Even the dessert will have pork in it.
Oh, come now. I'll ask you about that later. Okay.
Well, think of bacon candy, you know.
Oh,
I mean,
oh.
Bacon goes really well with sweets, you know.
Oh, very good. The idea. It seems like the producers of this kind of pork are farm owners, farmers themselves, and farm families. We mentioned the word CAFO before, and that is a whole different kind, as I understand it. It's a whole different kind of economic model. CAFO, what is that?
Confined feeding animal operation or something like that.
Those words are in
it's
there.
It's those
somehow.
Big barns that you drive around the highways in Iowa, you do not see livestock on the land the way, you know, it has, you know, 50 or more years ago, because the pigs are all in big barns. You don't see them.
You do smell them.
Yeah.
Now that is a whole different model because, okay, that big confinement facility, that big building is sitting out there in the country. Think, oh, that's a farmer's barn. That is not a farmer's barn. That belongs to the big investor that is running the whole shebang. And,
well, actually, yeah. a lot of times the farmers have to pay for them. I know, for example, Earl Hafner told me, on because he had, like many farmers, put one up and was not very happy, but he said, I have to keep doing this because I've invested $1 million in this building or something like that. So, you know, there was a time when they were, you know, in the get big or get out, and the farmers had to, and some of the same is true for chickens and turkeys also. And Iowa has a lot of these kinds of, although I have to say, Earl told me in the last derecho, one of his confinement operations got blasted in the storm, and you know, obviously, hopefully, he has insurance to cover that. But he's not going to rebuild that and that as another CAFO.
That was fortuitous. Well, I shouldn't say that.
No,
was fortuitous,
yeah. Anyway, it's but it is a big controversy, especially in Iowa. You know, when there's a big CAFO, the land values around it can drop because there's odors that emanate from it. And it's not just that it smells bad. There are volatiles in the air from all of the, you know, the excrement, and it's not a healthy thing. There have been big issues in North Carolina over this, especially because North Carolina is another big pig producing area, and when they've had the big storms out on the ocean, that the hurricanes come in and have caused a lot of flooding. And when that flooding hits the manure, they're called lagoons, right? Okay. We're not talking about a tropical place to swim.
I like that
it's
word.
It's a manure lagoon, right? So when the big storms wash in from the ocean, and if they come far enough inland, and they have in North Carolina, that they flood the lagoons. Now the lagoons are highly toxic. So it's really problematic.
Yeah, not that animal manure is bad in itself, but you can
concentrate
too much of a good thing.
Well, I mean, even in your soil, you know, from probably using chicken dung, for example, if the chicken dung is too, as they say, hot, if it's too fresh, you can, quote, burn your plants, right? That's why composting, you have to let the manure age. Now we do a lot of spreading of the lagoons in Iowa as fertilizer on the field, and you can smell it when it's season. Oh, this is Paul calling.
Oh, good.
Take over a second here.
So yes, all of this stuff is kind of these two ideas of how to raise pigs. And one is a big industrial model, and one is a smaller farm-operated model. Both of them make money. I mean, these are businesses. Businesses have to make money. And Nyman Ranch is one way of getting pork to the table. I like pork, too. And actually, it's a different way. Instead of treating animals as a cog in a big industrial system, it treats animals, pork and pigs in this as something of a partnership like farmers used to always have with their animals. It's growing them out in the air with good conditions, humanely, and it's always good. It's always good. Kiwana Kitchen, and we come to you from KHOI Community Radio. Well, this is the Donna Lana Kitchen Community Radio for the heart of Iowa. We are talking about pork today, and we are talking about Nyman Ranch. Paul Willis is with us.
Okay, Paul, are you there?
I'm here.
Oh,
yes.
Oh, good. Well, we've spent the last 20 minutes talking about you. Now we'll talk with you. So tell us a little bit about how you started your part of Nyman Ranch.
Okay, I was raising pasture-raised hogs, and it was that period of time in the 90s when there were lots of factory farms beginning to be built, and it became more and more the way pigs were being raised, and I was in one of these buildings, or maybe a couple of them, and I just decided I didn't want to raise pigs like that ever. And I saw somebody at a grocery store buy a free-range chicken and paid more money. And I asked this lady, why she bought that free-range chicken. She said, well, it tastes better. And besides, I like the way it's raised. And that got me thinking is that what I was doing was becoming more and more unique, pasture-raised pork. And I started looking for a way to market this, and it took me some time, but eventually through a mutual friend of mine who was marketing lamb in San Francisco to Bill Nyman, anyway, that was my connection, and I met Bill Nyman, who was in San Francisco selling some beef, lamb, and a little bit of pork, basically to the restaurant business in the Bay Area. And I knew that this was to identify a market, this was an area where people were maybe ahead of the curve as far as interest in where their food was coming from, how it was raised, and so on. So we hit it off, and eventually we sent some pork to the West Coast. Some of the chefs tried this. They were really impressed with the eating quality. And I had to figure out, how does a live animal get from my farm to San Francisco as products? And as Bill said, it's got to be here 5:30 Monday morning.
Alive or dead?
Initially we didn't even know, but we decided it should be processed in the Midwest and shipped out as meat, basically, and the primal cuts. So that's what we were figuring out. And I went to see some people at Supreme Pack. They were very helpful to tell me how the trucking worked when the animals were processed, and then the chilling that has to take place, and how long did that take, and then the next step of cutting the carcass into primal cuts, and then when did it have to get on a truck to head to the West Coast to get there 5:30 Monday morning. So I took 30 hogs in February of 95, and that's the first Nyman pigs that we sent, and that was the beginning of what later became the Nyman Ranch Pork Company.
Fantastic.
Well, let's talk about the eating quality of Nyman Ranch and pork, and also the Nyman Ranch program that rewards farmers for certain qualities that make the meat better. Can you tell us a little bit about that part of your Nyman Ranch protocol?
Well, yeah, and originally my idea was that I wanted to distance myself as far as possible from the commodity pork industry.
Mm-hmm.
And so animal welfare, how the animals were raised, was critical in my book. And in fact, I wanted to have some kind of certification, like Good Housekeeping Seal of Approval or something like that. Animal welfare certification, as it became came to be known eventually. And then no antibiotics ever came later, but that became part of the protocol. And it was important that the animals were owned and taken care of by the farmers. All of these criteria were worked into the to what a Nyman Ranch animal was. And right from the beginning, I'll never forget this, but Bill Nyman asked me, what do you want for your pigs? And, you know, raising pigs for the commodity world, no hog buyer had ever asked me that question.
They tell you what they're going to give you, right?
Right. You basically had to kind of beg for a price, right? Who's going to get, you know, and there was very little from one buyer to the next. And you were at the whims of the market going up and down. And later on in 1998, it actually went down very low, 10 cents a pound for a live hog.
I seem to remember that, and I was glad that I was not raising pigs at the time. My goodness.
a full-size market hog brought $20.
Okay, folks. Okay, folks. Think of that. Think of that. Even if you don't know anything about farm economics, think of that. Okay?
So we were paying a fair price to the farmers, and even during that period of time, we were paying enough that that hog, that same hog, was bringing over $100.
Yeah.
So how do you do that? Obviously, on a wholesale market, people, you know, like restaurants, for example, will pay more for better quality produce. So how does Nyman Ranch, how can they afford to pay above market? How do you do that?
Well, one of the things that we had to educate people on is that this is not pork as usual.
It's not the other white meat, right?
It's not the other white meat. This is the other red meat, and it's pasture raised or in pasture or deep bedded pens. And we also taste tested every new pork from every new farmer that came on, and you had to do, you know, the animal welfare part of it, but you also had to have the right type of genetics. And that was not what was being used in the industrial system. They were breeding pigs to be leaner and leaner, and as a result, they became more hyper, high-strung, and so on. And they ended up having tough, dry, tasteless pork, as opposed to our product was tender and juicy and flavorful.
It sounds like the CAFO raised or industrial raised, of course they're going to breed pigs that probably can at least survive in a confinement system. What kind of pig do you have? A certain breed that you use for pasture raised, or is that a variable sort of thing?
It's a variable, but typically our farmers have a three-way cross, Duroc, Berkshire, Chester White. We like those breeds. Mm-hmm. Each one of those breeds brings something, and the crossbred pigs have more vigor. They grow better, and you can still maintain the eating quality. But we've always paid a lot of attention to that. If you took those pigs out of confinement, even if you raised them outdoors, they wouldn't be good. They're too lean, too hyper, mm-hmm. prone to stress. All those things are negatives when it comes to eating quality. The industrial part of the business wasn't paying much attention to the eating quality.
Right.
That was something that we recognized and.
Now, did that come to you because you'd been raising pigs for, what, your whole life? Did you grow up on a farm that raised pigs?
Well, I grew up on the farm. I learned how to raise pasture pigs growing up, and then I left the farm for a few years. And then when I went back, I started helping on the farm, and then I basically started with just a very few pigs and started expanding this herd and raising pasture pigs. I knew how to do this, and honestly, I didn't know the type of genetics that I had was so dramatically better than industrial pigs when I started this. I was, in some ways, lucky.
Well, you've been eating that good pork your whole life, so that's how pork is supposed to taste, right?
Yeah, well, I didn't know the difference, honestly.
Well, yeah, you mentioned before the red meat, white meat stuff, and the idea of pale white pork, that doesn't necessarily mean that's a good thing.
So, no, that's the worst thing.
See, and once again, we get this marketing line, and I think, yeah, I think meat that tastes good is good. I want to ask you, as someone that raises pigs, is raising pigs on pasture, doing it your way, is that hard work as opposed to, aren't these confinement facilities supposed to be efficient and all that sort of stuff? How does it affect the farmer in each case?
Well, the way we raise pigs is, yes, it's a lot of work. It requires more management, more actually attention really paid to, watching the pigs, learning to identify, what they're thinking, what they're doing, all of these, are they exhibiting their natural behaviors, but at the same time, it's really rewarding, especially in the springtime, to go out every morning and you're looking in your little houses, porta huts or hay houses and everything, and to see what new litters of pigs you have. They're in bedding, and I would say that our farmers enjoy raising pigs, and they enjoy raising them the way we do it. Most of our farmers, I would say, would not be interested in working in a confinement building or having one or, really wanting any part of that.
Good. I've met some other pasture pig farmers, and the joy of actually
baby animals.
Interacting with animals is a really good thing. I have a question about tails. I read that Nyman Ranch does not dock tails. Does that take the tail off? What about tails? Why do some farmers and confinement farmers take the tails off of their animals? What is that about?
Well, it's about tail biting.
Biting.
When you put animals in a confined situation and they're overly crowded and they're bred and they're more hyper, tail biting is almost inevitable. And tail biting is it's a symptom of a problem.
Ah.
So we don't dock tails, and rarely when the pigs have room, plenty of space, whether it's in a hoop barn with lots of bedding or in the pasture and so on, it's ordinarily not a problem. If it is a problem, it's an indication that you've got something wrong.
Does the same thing go for the teeth clipping thing that Nyman Ranch also does not do? Why are the teeth clipped?
That's what we started asking ourselves and realized that there's no reason. The reason, I think, was that with very large litters, the pigs will fight each other for when it comes to nursing time, mm-hmm. and they'll cut each other's noses up, and you can get, some infections on the noses and everything.
Oh, the piglets. Piglets. It's a little like debeaking that they use in chicken confinements,
yeah.
Right?
Oh, that's true.
But in a natural system, nobody cuts teeth on a baby pig, and they do just fine. And I was doing it because everybody else was doing it, and then I stopped, and I saw no difference whatsoever. And that also, that teeth clipping allows for infections to get into the, you know, you're opening a wound, really, you know?
Well, yeah, and it also seems like a very unpleasant labor practice.
Yeah, there's no reason to really do it.
So we're getting back to pigs being pigs and letting them have a whole lot to say about how they are raised. I want to take a little break here. This is KHOI, listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. For more information about the Donna Lana Kitchen, you can go to khoifm.org. Welcome back. We are talking to Paul Willis.
All right. I want to talk about something that I learned from Paul is how to cook a pork belly. Yeah. So, Paul, tell us your recipe for pork belly.
Well, a pork belly ordinarily is something that's cured and it becomes bacon.
Mm-hmm.
But a raw pork belly or green pork belly is an uncured belly that comes off a slab that comes off the belly of the pig, and I like roasted pork belly, and it's absolutely delicious. But what I do, put some cayenne, some fennel seed, maybe some sage. That's what I use. But there's other, you know, spices or things that you can put on, a rub, but basically. And you maybe put that on for, you know, rub it on the belly and let it sit there for a day or so.
In the fridge.
And then, pardon?
Keep it in the fridge while you've got the rub on.
In the fridge.
Mm-hmm.
And then I put this piece in a cake pan, maybe on a little bit of a rack or something. And with a piece of aluminum foil in the bottom of the pan or something, and I put it in the oven about 10 o'clock at night, about the time you're ready to go to bed, and put it on about 215 or 220.
Ooh, long and low, yeah.
Leave it on there, and in the morning it's done.
And it's so delicious. I mean, the first time I ever had your pork belly, of course, now I've cooked it a lot myself because I love it. It's very rich, of course, because of the fat, and you kind of just, it's fun to serve like, just in little 1-inch cubes, basically, to your dinner guests.
Yeah.
But what I liked about your recipe was the fennel that you add to the flavor, because fennel and fennel seed, or ground fennel seed and pork is just a marriage made in heaven. So I always put fennel on my pork belly.
Well,
yeah, I agree, Donna. And the slow cooking process, you render the fat out of the belly. Basically, it melts,
mm-hmm.
and then you can pour off that excess.
You can save it and use it for other things. It's good.
Yeah, right. But, you know, so it's still, you know, a fatty product, but a lot of it has melted off by that time or rendered off.
So when you're doing your standards, your culinary standards for Diamond Ranch pork, what are the things that you look for and what do you kind of give a premium to your farmers for in terms of meat characteristics?
Well, I remember I told you about paying the fair price in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
We've maintained that. Now we have over 600 Nyman Ranch hog farmers now, but we pay a premium price, and it fluctuates based on the cost of feed, which is 60-80% of the cost of raising a pig.
So the more the farmer has to pay, the more you can compensate him to make it viable for
him. Yeah, because we don't want our farmers to ever be losing money. So it's better for the animals, better for the farmers, better for the environment. We don't have the number of pigs that you might find in a confinement building. Each building holds maybe 2,500 head. We have a few farmers that raise that many pigs in a year, but certainly not in a building, but spread over a large area of different buildings and pasture and so forth.
And how do you have like a team that sets your culinary standards or something like that?
Well, we pull samples from our farmers when they sell hogs, and we have a series of tests that relates to the eating quality. So
somebody's cooking a lot of pork and you're just tasting it, or what are you looking at? Marbling?
No, there's marbling, shear test, color, pH, all these things. We have a formula that mm-hmm. Translates to the...
Okay, tell us what a shear test is.
Well, just how tender.
Okay. Uh-huh.
It would be.
Good. Okay.
No, Donna and I, actually, Donna's turned me on to this a lot because she's a great cook. And we often think about cooking parts of the animal that you don't normally find in a supermarket meat department. You talked about sending off the prime cuts or the primal cuts to Nyman Ranch. Do they take all the other parts too, or... I like the trotters and all that. So what happens to the rest of the pig?
Okay, first of all, the primal cuts are basically the leg, which is the back leg. Mm-hmm. There's the loin, which is the back, basically, the belly and the front part of the animal, the front legs. Mm-hmm. And so there's four. You know, on a hog, you split it, there's four primal cuts. So initially it was shipped that way, and then it was further cut down, you know, on the out of the loin comes pork chops and spare ribs and things like that. But, yes, there's hocks, there's a number of things that can become trim, or they go into things like sausage and so on. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We sell things like whole heads.
Oh,
we have chefs that like to do things with the heads.
Very good.
Heads are hard to find, I have to tell you.
We can sell you tails, by the way.
Really? What about ears and feet?
The front feet we have, but the back feet is where the animal, the carcass, is hung.
Oh,
and that becomes a throwaway piece. Goes into rendering, but yeah.
Well,
we have hocks and things like that.
I love cooking with pork feet, and it is hard to find a pork foot in Iowa in the grocery store. I have to say, cooking with a foot. You throw one in the stock pot, and it makes, I call it velvet. It makes this soft, unctuous, rich, rich, rich stock, and that's because the collagen is being boiled out of the feet, among other things. So I vote for more pork feet being available in Iowa, I must say.
Parts, and actually healthy and happy pork parts. That sounds good to me. Yes, it does. Very good.
Well, you know, we do get a better price in the marketplace because our product is a different product. It's not commodity pork, and Nyman Ranch pork are two different things.
Well, the Nyman Ranch in the last few years, is I've seen in the markets, even in Ames, a lot of Nyman Ranch sausage, some Nyman Ranch, all kinds of other uses of meat, so you're doing more value-added products, probably with the bits that aren't sold as primals, I suppose, right?
Yeah, no, that's one of the things, you know, we say that, you know, it's a farm-to-fork program, but the Nyman Ranch is the two part. So, you know, we have some farmers that do some direct sales, mm-hmm. you know, farmers markets, things like that, but I think everybody runs across this this problem of marketing the entire carcass, because you can't just market half of it.
Right.
You know,
once people buy the spare ribs and the pork chops, there's the whole rest of it.
Yeah, not everybody wants pig's feet, you know, and these things. But you know, we do a pretty good job of figuring out how to use those other products and find a place for it, a value-added place. And you know, take that. That's why, you know, some farmers, what they like to do is raise pigs. They don't really want to be involved in the marketing part of it.
No, that's so a whole separate business.
yeah. And it's... So anyway, we're always looking for new ways of finding, you know, hams is a big one. It's a big part of the animal, and believe it or not, it's one of the, you know, kind of hardest things to market.
Oh, how come? Because people just eat ham on Easter and Christmas, right?
It's a seasonal. Yeah, it's a seasonal. It is, especially if you're, you know, so we make ham steaks and we make some smaller cuts and things like that are more popular during the non-holiday seasons. But, you know, most people, if they're going to get a half ham or a full-size bone-in ham or something, it's going to be, you know, for a special occasion.
Well, I already told our audience that you say that your pigs only have one bad day in their life, and I want to thank you, Paul, for doing this, for making these kinds of pigs available for all of us to eat, and for helping other farmers do that. So thank you, Paul Willis.
Thank you for joining us today. We've been talking to Paul Willis, and you've been talking about raising pork.
In Iowa.
And and distributing it all over through the Nyman Ranch program. So very good. Thank you, Paul, for being with us today.
Oh, well, thank you.
You've been listening to the Donalana Kitchen. We come to you live at noon. We're repeated at 7 p.m. on this fine radio station. You can find out even more and find out about downloading and streaming and all that kind of stuff at khoyfm.org. And Donna, tell us, we have a new project.
Oh, our podcast, yes. So the same thing that you've been listening to on the radio for the last 8 years is now in a podcast format. So go to wherever you listen to podcasts, like Spotify or Apple or something, and put in Donalana Kitchen. That's Donalana, that's one word, D-O-N-N-A-L-O-N-N-A, Kitchen, separate word, and you will find us in the podcast format.
Very good. Yes, we're learning how to do these new things, and we appreciate your support, and we appreciate lending us your ears every now and then. Yes, yes. We had music today by the Barn Owl Band. You heard Texas Gals, and we'll go out with a tune called Swinging on a Gate. Yes, we will. Support this fine community radio station. Thanks for joining the Donalana Kitchen today. My name is Lana Nachtigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We had fine engineering by Mike Murphy. Eat good food and enjoy life.